Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Video may not have killed the radio star, as the old song claimed, but digital is sure doing a number on news outlets here and around the country. The internet and smartphones have virtually gutted print media and are weighing heavily on other forms of news production that aspires to traditional journalistic standards. It could be argued that the funding model has ceased to work, or at the very least is seriously challenged. And that was before the COVID-19 stay-at-home orders resulted in business closings. When that happened, news operations relying on advertising revenues were dealt another blow as that revenue vanished overnight. If this has been a problem for larger news operations, and it has, what must it be like at smaller niche publications? And before you rush to minimize their contributions, remember that many of those publications serve underserved communities that rely on them to stay informed. They fill in the gaps in coverage from the mainstream media. We wanted to talk about how these smaller operations are faring during this pandemic and how they've adapted and examined the challenges they face trying to fulfill their missions now and in the best of times. And so we're joined by the leaders of four of those publications. Hilda Gerdian is publisher and founder of La Noticia, the primary media outlet serving the Latino community across North Carolina. Good morning and thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Very happy to be here with you, Mike.
Nice to have you. Glenn Berkins is founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com, which focuses on the Black community here, and a frequent guest on our News Friday Roundup. Good morning to you, Glenn.
Good morning.
Tony Mesilla is founder and publisher of the Charlotte Ledger, a business newsletter focused on professionals too busy to read an entire paper, it says. And he joins us usually on Thursday mornings with Marshall Terry on Morning Edition. Is that right?
That's right. Thursday mornings. Good morning, Mike. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you here. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder of Queen City Nerve, an alternative media company that delivers their publication both online and in print. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to hear from all of you on this first question, and we'll start with you, Hilda. Given the challenges that journalism is facing and was facing prior to this pandemic, compare your operation and how you were doing business and the struggles and challenges you faced prior to the COVID-19 outbreak to what's going on right now.
Well, right now we are working harder than ever, working long days, long hours in the day and many hours in the night, trying to keep our readers informed on this fast-moving coronavirus news. So we're working much more than ever before. LaNoticia.com has grown tremendously because of our coverage for coronavirus, which is good. I mean, it's a good change. We have quadrupled our audience, and La Noticia print has become a very important source of information. In many cases, has become the only source of information for many Latino members of our community who do not have internet access.
All right. Ryan, what about you?
So editorially, it's been sort of just an interesting expedited process as far as really trying to focus on news coverage and hard news coverage as opposed to some of the arts and culture. We still are doing a lot of the arts and culture and food coverage that we usually do, but we're tying it into a more hard news angle as far as COVID-19 coverage. And then on the business side of things, my business partner, publisher Justin LaFrancois has sort of almost overnight in the last less than a month brought on a paid subscription model to help us with the fact that most of our distribution spots around the city have been closed and there's not many places to get our paper. So we are still continuing to deliver the free paper to outdoor boxes throughout the city, but there aren't a lot of people out to get them. So we have offered a paid subscription model to sort of supplement that and give people that option to have it delivered to their door.
Wow. Tony.
Yeah, so it's been really interesting. Obviously, you know, for a lot of news organizations, the last the last few weeks, I could say, you know, the Charlotte Ledger, you know, we're traditionally a business e-newsletter that came out 3-4 times a week. Since this hit, you know, we've really ramped it up. We've been going 6 or 7 days a week. We've sort of broadened our focus to not cover only business, but to, you know, talk about the things that the community needs, telling stories of how Charlotte's changing, how people are changing, how businesses are changing. And there's been a tremendous interest in that. I think everybody on this panel would say the interest in local news now is as high as it's ever been. But on the business side, our model is a little bit different than some of the others on this panel in the sense that we don't really rely that much on advertising or sponsorship revenue. We always had intended to have a paid subscription model in which, you know, we give you a couple of days a week for free. If you want the other days of the week, you pay a modest amount, $9 a month. And so that really hasn't, we haven't really been hurt by that. You know, a little bit of the sponsorships have dropped off, but, you know, we're still seeing very strong interest in, you know, in paying for, news that people need.
Go ahead.
My situation probably mirrors Lanetizia's more than the others. Lots of long hours, way more hours. We've been around since 2008. And except for very episodic things like the Democratic National Convention or maybe the CIAA tournament, we're working harder than we've ever worked before. And unlike those other things that last just a week or two or a few days, this has been protracted. So day after day after day, we're working longer hours. We're generating more copy. Like La Noticia, we've seen our online traffic explode. And at the same time, we've seen revenue plummet. About before the pandemic, probably 70% of our revenue came from entertainment type things, helping other organizations promote their events. Well, there are no events now, none, right. Zero, except online. And so those sources of revenue have dried up. The good news in that story is that our readers have increased their giving. We have a membership program that allows readers to go on our site and join what we call our press club. And we've seen many more people doing that since the pandemic. And that's one of the things that is kind of helping us pay the bills during this difficult time.
We chose the four of you and your four publications because each of you and each of your publications speaks to a unique audience, and each of those communities that you serve has been uniquely impacted by this virus. Glenn, you were among the first people, maybe the first, to report in Q City Metro and then shared with us on the roundup that the African American community was uniquely being impacted by this virus. Hilda, you and Glenn speak to communities that haven't really... Well, that haven't really received help from government in this crisis. It's not getting through to them. And Tony, you're speaking to small businesses. They, too, are having trouble getting the help promised them and the help that Congress passed. They just can't seem to access that cash. And Ryan, many of your readers are, and the people that you cover, are artists who struggle in the good times to make ends meet and make a living. And were it not for your efforts, we wouldn't really know much about them, and now they're struggling to make it through this. Were it not for your four publications, would these struggles be addressed or acknowledged by local media, Ryan?
I don't think in the way that I would like to see it, and that goes for the arts and music scene as well as different community-oriented journalism that we try to do in our news coverage, such as in our latest paper. I spent 2 to 3 weeks reporting at a homeless encampment there on North College Street that has popped up and spent time getting to know folks and really learn their stories, as opposed to a lot of times when you see folks reporting on such communities, you'll see them pop in and pop out and get a good soundbite. And I just think that's the importance of some of these outlets that we're here with today, is that doing that community-based journalism that's a little more in-depth and takes the time as opposed to more soundbite-based things to where people can actually get a grasp on the real situation on the ground.
And Tony, your newsletter, the Charlotte Ledger, is aimed at smaller business people, not necessarily the big banks or major corporations. And these are the people who have been promised recovery money and it's just not getting through to most of them. How are you covering that? What are you hearing from your readers about that?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, we'll cover small businesses, and we do cover the banks and some of the larger businesses as well. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's just talking to business owners a lot and trying to, you know, reflect that point of view. And I mean, certainly there are other business publications, you know, in town that do that. But I think, you know, we're trying to cover it in a way that hasn't been covered. It wouldn't really make a whole lot of sense for us to do exactly the same thing that the larger outlets are doing. So, you know, kind of like Ryan and like really everybody on this panel, we're trying to find those stories and those opportunities to do the kind of journalism that's not otherwise being done. So I think that's a valuable you know, contribution. And you know, you've just seen, you know, it used to be in town here, you know, you had the Observer, you had the TV stations, you had an alt weekly, you had Charlotte Magazine, you had a few small things, but it was really controlled by you know, fewer voices. And now you're seeing a lot more voices. Now they tend to be smaller than they have been in the past. They don't have the audience. They don't have the reach of, you know, the Observer in its heyday of, you know, 250,000 paid subscribers, but you know, but they're telling important stories and they are reaching different audiences. And so that's kind of what we're trying to do with The Ledger.
I mentioned, Glenn, in QCityMetro.com, you were among the first, if not the first, to explore the fact that the African-American community is being overrepresented in the number of COVID-19 infections and the number of people dying from this virus. And both you and Hilda Gurdian at La Noticia have canvassed your readers, and you found not a single person of color who has received any benefit from the Paycheck Protection Program. Did that surprise either of you? I'll start with you, Glenn.
No, it really hasn't surprised me. But in all fairness, I know people who are not Black or African American small business owners, and they're talking about the same struggles. I think there is a bigger problem with just small business owners, period, getting that help they need. And then after you drill down, African-Americans are having an even tougher time because they tend not to have the same banking relationships. There was a Federal Reserve study back in 2018 that pointed to the fact that small businesses owned by African-Americans were much more dependent on home equity to launch and survive. And they just don't have those same banking relationships. So I'm not at all surprised to see this. I'm disheartened and I'm disappointed, but not surprised.
Hilda, explain the problem in the Latino community. I'm not getting these checks.
We have, where from the health perspective, we are disproportionately affected also. The Latino community, the 15% of the people with COVID-19 in the state are Latinos, and we represent about 9% of the population in the state. And from the economic perspective, we are greatly impacted because, as we all know, a large majority of the Latino community work in restaurants and hotels, and those businesses are closed. So they are without a job, without an income. So they don't have money to pay the rent or to pay food. And plus, they don't qualify for many of the items on the stimulus packages that we have created, the governments have created locally, statewide and federal. So they are suffering a lot. And one thing that I'd like to make clear is that it is really sad what is happening in the Latino community, because—
Let me stop you. We have to stop, Hilda. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the the health or lack of health among smaller publications and journalism in general around the country here, with four people who run niche publications that are, serve particular audiences here in the Charlotte area. Hilda Gerdian is the founder and publisher of La Noticia, which serves the Latino community, almost exclusively serves the, they're the exclusive server almost of the Latino community. Glenn Birkins, founder publisher of QCityMetro.com. Tony Macia, founder publisher of Charlotte Ledger, which is a business publication. And Ryan Pitkin, co-founder of Queen City Nerve, which is an alternative publication featuring arts and culture and music, etc. Hilda, I had to stop you, so let me finish what you were talking about just before the break.
The 38% of the Latino community in North Carolina is undocumented, but they pay taxes. The only thing is that they pay taxes with the I-10, which is also called the W-7, not with a social security number. So for that reason, they don't qualify for the benefits.
Okay. Tony, your publication, The Charlotte Ledger, was started, I think, about a year ago. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, about a year ago, as a three-day-a-week publication, now you have 6 to 7 editions a week. You're not a paper. You are a newsletter. You're not in print. You are online only. And you don't rely, as you pointed out, and you never have, on advertising. You use this paid subscription model. How's that working? I mean, have you been impacted by people who are now out of work and can't pay the subscription?
All I can tell you is that our numbers are growing and that they're going up, and we're adding people every single day. And so, you know, wow. You do worry in a recession, you know, like the one that we're in, or hasn't quite been declared yet, but that they're going to say that we're in, is that that eventually people don't have money and they don't subscribe to you. I'm not really seeing that. I'm still seeing subscription growth. People, you know, saying, listen, you know, we want a reliable source of information, something that covers, you know, the business community, does it in a smart way that's punchy, and that doesn't waste your time. So that's sort of the idea behind what we're doing. And I mean, I can tell you it seems to be going well. There's a tremendous appetite for for news. I think there always has been. I think a lot of times people, you know, you say, oh, local news is in peril. Nobody really cares about local news anymore. And a lot of times people see the problems that are going on with daily, you know, metro newspapers, and they say, oh, well, it must be that people don't care. And I can tell you that's absolutely not the case.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Mike, you talked about how things have changed for us. One of the ways we have had to change is we take on now, I think, much more of an advocacy role. We have been much more of an advocate for the African American community during this pandemic, because we've had to. I came up in mainstream media, major news organizations, where we were taught to be, you know, objective, kind of stand back from the story, and that's the way I was taught journalism, and I still prefer that style of journalism, but we find ourselves hewing to a slightly different standard now, because lives are at stake. This isn't just some philosophical discussion. This is about life and death. We were also the first to write about the fact that there were no testing centers in poor and communities of color. And now both of our healthcare organizations, major healthcare organizations, are doing major testing in those communities.
Do you think you're responsible for that?
Well, I'm not going to take the credit for that. I will say that we did raise the issue. I have no way of knowing how that played out in the offices or the corner offices of these healthcare organizations.
I didn't really hear anybody else beating the drum besides Glenn.
Well, thank you, Tony. But we've had to take on that role. Right. If we don't take on that role, who's going to do it?
Do you do something similar for the Latino community, given the fact that many of those people truly do need advocates?
Yes, at La Noticia, that's what we do. I mean, Glenn is so right. We have become advocates. We have to really let the community at large know what is going on in the Latino community, how much our people are suffering. And the healthcare system is started a testing center on the east side, and as we know, a large Latino population live and work on that part of town as well as on the west. So they're now serving more our African Americans and Latino communities.
The whole idea of, because most of you have deep backgrounds in mainstream papers. I know, Tony, you worked for The Observer for years. So did you, Glenn. You've run a newspaper, Hilda, for years. And I'm not sure of your background, Ryan, but I'm sure it's been a long time in print. The whole idea of advocacy journalism. I understand what you're saying and why you feel it needs to be done. But what do you think that's doing to journalism? We have advocacy journalism on steroids at Fox News. We have something similar to that at MSNBC on the other side. We have public newspapers have always on their editorial pages taken a stance, an advocacy stance on one side or the other. But when this happens in the news columns of a publication, does it make your skin crawl that you're doing this? Or do you really think that this is something that has to be done in this environment and in order for you as smaller publications to stay alive? I'm not sure who should answer.
Well,
that.
I think there's a big difference between sort of what's happening at Fox News and then going out from a journalist with a journalist's integrity and doing journalism based on facts and research for a certain cause. And telling what I've always said is that any story that I tell, whether it be about, say, dirt bike crews in the city that are getting a bad rap on TV news that are getting only one side of the story told, or it be something like what Glenn's been reporting on with testing sites, you always just have to make sure that you are not you're telling both sides of the story, or at least giving both sides a chance to explain themselves. And that's where integrity comes in. And then if somebody is telling untruths, then you uncover that as well. And I think that's an important part of it.
Glenn?
The other thing that I would point out is that this is really kind of back to the future. We tend to think of media as being objective and unbiased. And that is certainly a worthwhile goal, but that is really not the history of media in the United States. No. And so we're kind of going back to that. And that's certainly not the history of the Black press. The Black press was founded in the years after abolition. And they certainly did not take an objective view on civil rights, human rights, the issues that impacted freedmen of that time. So the Black press has always been and always had to be an advocate for its community in a way that sometimes other mainstream media organizations have not had to.
Hilda. And I think, Mike, if I...
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
That's okay, Tony. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, there is a certain honesty to it that every reporter, even reporters that are writing supposedly neutral news articles, each reporter brings to it his or her own opinions, biases. Now you can tune those out to a great degree, but I think there's a certain honesty that readers appreciate in saying, listen, okay, here are the facts. I'm uncovering facts and sort of here's how I'm framing them, and here's my opinion on them. And I don't think we necessarily always tell readers what to think. Readers, I think, tend to be pretty smart and pretty savvy. I think we do tell them sort of what to think about, and we do highlight issues that they might not otherwise know about. And so, you know, I struggle with it a little bit in the sense that I prefer to just sort of put the facts out and let them fall where they may. But I think we're in an era where I think a lot of people sort of appreciate the, you know, they might not agree with you, but I think a lot of them appreciate sometimes the honesty that that you have by saying, listen, this is where I'm coming from and this is what I think and here are the facts. You know, if you disagree, go ahead.
Hilda, you've been waiting patiently. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mike. I was going to add that this is the right thing to do for us news organizations serving the community of color, because we tell stories that are affecting our communities that nobody else is going to talk about. Otherwise, if we don't say those stories, they will go untold, and that will be unfair to our community. Plus, I would like to say that Glenn and I are in a Charlotte Journalism collaborative, and that they have introduced to us a new technique that is called solutions journalism. That is also, we are going to talk about the issue, of course, but we also are going to try to bring a solution to the issue. So that is the new way of doing things. And to us, I think it pays off, and the community is well represented now through our stories.
It should be noted that WFAE is also part of that collaboration. Right.
That's true.
Thank you for noting that for me. I appreciate that. You're exactly right. Outside of, really big newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post and a few others scattered about the country, major U.S. dailies are in trouble and have been for some time. And they were in trouble before this pandemic. And Glenn, you have said that you believe that this pandemic might be, and this kind of just jumped off the page to me, might be an extinction even for journalism. Extinction is a pretty big word here. So explain that.
I did not come up with that phrase. I can't remember where I read it. It was one of the industry gurus who follow the industry who said this could be an extinction event for local news, kind of like the meteor that struck the earth and got rid of the dinosaurs, because we've just seen revenue in some cases just cut so much. Even larger newspapers have had to resort to layoffs, have had to reduce the number of days. I got my start at the St. Petersburg Times in Florida. I can't remember, but I think they cut their days, their print publication, to Wednesday and Sunday, I believe. They've had to let go workers, and they are now asking their readers for contributions. That's something you would not have seen 5 years ago. That's something you wouldn't have seen before the pandemic, really. Having major news organizations, legacy news organizations, asking for donations. So when all is said and done, I think there will be fewer news organizations, fewer newspapers in particular. I think there will be fewer and fewer public online publications like Q City Metro. We were struggling in the best of times. It's not like we found a great business model that works. We were still pioneers trying to make this thing work. And I think when this is over, we're going to have far fewer people in cities all over the country reporting local news.
Yeah, I have seen, particularly in online versions of publications, notes to readers to please support the journalism that they're reading by making a contribution. And it's kind of a public radio model. Is it working for print and digital publications? Is it working for you guys? Anybody want to answer that?
Well, Glenn?
Ryan.
This is Glenn Hess.
I'm sorry. Say it again, Ryan. You broke up.
We have seen an increase in such donations as we've asked for them. A little bit more moving into this crisis. I do think that's a sort of it's a thing going forward, but you also want to find out ways in which you can add advantages to it, be it like, say, for example, our subscription model. It's a small thing to have one on your door as opposed to go pick it up for free on the street, but it's a thing that people appreciate and hopefully will continue to appreciate past the quarantine. But we're also offering partnerships with different venues and restaurants and things like that to offer discounts. So I think stuff like that also helps.
Well, I was going to ask you how you go from being free to then telling people that we'll deliver it to your door, but you have to have a subscription. How well that's going and how people reacted. How did your readers react to that?
Well, I think for the first wave, if you will, of folks who have signed up, and we have gotten good numbers, is folks who are supporters already and want to find a way that they can help. So it is almost like a, we're asking you to support local journalism by becoming almost, we worded it in some ways as you're partnering with us, but we're also offering advantages, like I said, with by offering, you know, we're going to be partnering with venues and things.
Why is this happening? Explain to people who don't care or don't pay much attention to journalism or publications or anything like that. Why is that happening? Why does the advertising model that has worked for 100 years suddenly not working for print? Why didn't it work when print migrated a lot of what they do to the internet? Is it simply because people think if it's on the internet, it ought to be free? Is that what's happening here?
I think what you had, Mike, is that, you know, traditionally, if you look at newspapers, they had always had revenue from both subscribers, you know, in the form of subscriptions, you know, guys selling it on the street, extra, extra, read all about it, you know, in addition to advertising. Advertising was a big portion of it. I think newspapers, I think, tended to get away from that a little bit more and shift more toward the advertising model, thinking that they could make money off of digital advertising. You know, when the internet came along, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, I think in hindsight, that wound up to be a colossal error. And now they're trying to rectify that. And it's a question of, is it a little bit too late? So I think you are seeing, you know, a move toward every, you know, publication, every news outlet trying to find, you know, its listeners or its readers as a source of revenue, whether it's a membership type of model, whether it's a sort of a pass the hat kind of model, whether it's a subscription model. I think you're seeing a little bit more of a return to that. I mean, the issue is exactly what we're going through right now, that if you become too dependent on advertising and all the advertising dries up, that's a huge, huge problem.
And
the
Ryan,
go
ahead, Glenn.
No, I was going to say the other thing that's happening there that we just can't ignore is Facebook, Google, those online organizations have just siphoned off a huge amount of revenue from traditional media. Now, they have these sophisticated algorithms and sophisticated models for reaching audiences. And, you know, just think of it. A page of classified ads back in the day, you know, I can't remember how many, you know, tens of thousands of dollars just one page of classified ads used to bring in for print publications. Furniture companies, car dealers, grocery stores,
real estate,
used to buy full page ads, double trucks, two pages. Mm-hmm. That was, newspapers were actually printing money. And now that has gone online.
Glenn Berkins used to be with The Observer, but for years now he's been the founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. He's here with Tony Macia from the Charlotte Ledger, Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve, and Hilda Gurdy from La Noticia. We're coming right back.
Hey y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. On this week's episode of Southbound, we talked to Todd May, a philosophy professor at Clemson, who is an advisor on the TV show The Good Place. You can find this and every episode of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org.
Support for Southbound comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Group.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Hilda Gurdian joins us. She is the founder publisher of La Noticia, which serves the Latino community around North Carolina. Glenn Berkins, founder publisher of QCityMetro.com, serving the African American community in Charlotte. Tony Macia, founder and publisher of Charlotte Ledger, which is a business newsletter that is, focused at young professionals and those who are involved in all sorts of businesses, but primarily small business. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder of Queen City Nerve, which is the latest entry into the field of arts, culture, and music journalism. Let's talk about another funding model that has traditionally been kind of a public radio, public TV model that is also beginning to migrate into print, and that is grant money coming from, I guess, foundations and individuals. How many of your publications rely on any of that money coming in to keep you afloat?
Yes, we have been very fortunate in that way. We've gotten a number of grants that, frankly, without them, we probably would be in dire straits right now. We've gotten funding from the Knight Foundation, and we got some funding from another organization called Borealis Philanthropy. It's a national It's a national nonprofit that pools money from different sources. And in this case, they had a fund specifically for Black publishers. And not just foundations, but Facebook has done grants. They've pledged millions of dollars to help local media. Google has is soliciting grant applications now for local news organizations. So there is grant funding out there, but that's not going to last forever. And so if we're going to find a long-term solution, that grant funding is not going to, it's not going to be it.
Hilde, your publication is both online and it is print. And to the best of my knowledge, it has always been and continues to be free. And Ryan, your publication, up until the sources of delivery dried up because restaurants and places where people would pick up your paper to read it on the newsstands have closed during this pandemic. You've switched to a subscription model, but it has been free. And when you were with Creative,
it's still free too, if you can find it.
Okay, and when you were with Creative, in the heyday of Creative Loafing, right, and you used to be with them, I always wondered how they could do it, how they could be free, but the Observer could not. So explain to me, since you both run free print publications, how that's affordable. How do you make that work?
Right now, we are blessed to receive funding from grants.
Okay.
Like Glenn, we received one from Knight Foundation, Borealis, Facebook, and Google. They have given us grants. And I like to mention also that our Charlotte Journalism Collaborative is funded by the Knight Foundation. So we're very grateful to the Knight Foundation for being so supportive of high quality journalism. And I hope that many other local foundations will follow their steps because we really need their help. Now, those grants are coming to us with the understanding that we are going to create new business models like membership programs. For example, we are on with the Facebook Membership Accelerator Program, and that's exactly what we are doing. We are transforming our organization into a news organization that is going to be paid.
Brian.
And we have just, we've gotten some of that Facebook grant money that Glenn referred to, but we hadn't received any grants leading up to this crisis. Most of our income comes from advertising, print advertising, which I'm still a huge fighter for that works as a supplementary thing to spend money on. It's just about convincing people that that's something to put in as well as digital advertising or paying your PR people, which is another thing that takes that marketing money away, and social media folks and stuff like that. But we also host events such as South End Oktoberfest. Vodka Masters was supposed to be last weekend. So we're not only losing money in this crisis from advertising events, but from our own events. So that's another thing that adds to the income that is being harmed right now. And that's why we're just trying to get through this grant money and with creative opportunities such as the paid subscription edition.
So Tony, when you started Charlotte Ledger, to the best of my, correct me if I'm wrong, it was free. Every time it came out, all you had to do is subscribe to it, and it came into your inbox three times a week. Now you've expanded to six or seven deliveries a week, and you can read some of it for free, but there's a paywall at a certain price. Major newspapers have tried this over the years, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. How do you get people to pay for something that they expect to be free because you made it so at the beginning?
Well, we try to always be clear that this is not something that, you know, that as much as I enjoy doing it and I enjoy producing the Charlotte Ledger, that there are actually costs associated with it. And so we try to be clear about that from the beginning. But, you know, you have seen a number of news organizations do that. I mean, you know, famously, you know, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, they all have pretty hard paywalls in which they say, listen, we're providing you information. It's not free to produce. Right. And if you find value in it, you should pay for it. And that's sort of the same approach that I'm trying to take with the Charlotte Ledger. I'm just trying to provide value. And if people find value in what we give, and we're trying to give them, you know, original information and insights that they really can't get anywhere else, there's no point in us, you know, the Charlotte Ledger doing the exact same thing that everybody else is doing. So we're trying to provide original content that makes you smarter about Charlotte and say, listen, if you find value in that, please subscribe and you can get access to everything. If you don't find value in that, that's fine too. You'll still get a couple of days a week for free. But, you know, I think we need to sort of reestablish that what we do has actual value, Mike, and that, you know, and that if people, it should be like anything else. If you walk into Home Depot and you want some mulch, you know, you wouldn't ever say, well, I actually get to take this for free because, you know, Chick-fil-A is taking out a big ad on it. Of course not. If you want the mulch, you pay for the mulch. And I would hope that we're a little more interesting to read than mulch. But, you know, I would, if we need to establish that there's a value. And so if people find value in it, I think it's not unreasonable to ask them to pay for it.
Glenn.
I had a former colleague who said the worst thing media organizations ever did was start giving away their content for free, because it raised that expectation that it would be free. And it's and it downplayed the fact that it costs a lot of money to yes. produce quality news. If you want someone to go out, someone with journalism ability to go out and report and to deliver quality journalism, it costs a lot of money. And it's not a free proposition. And somehow we've got to get our readers and our viewers and our listeners to understand and appreciate that this is something worth protecting and this is something worth supporting.
I want to talk about content for just a couple of seconds here before we run out of time, because all of you have your own niches that you cover, arts and culture and the Latino community, things that are happening there, the African-American community, the business community. But right now, COVID-19 is everything. It's everything, mm-hmm. everywhere, it's COVID all the time. And some of you, I would think, are finding this to be either challenging or refreshing or both, because during this pandemic, Tony, you began covering news related to the virus. And you found that local health news is particularly in demand. But you're a business publication. Aren't your readers able to find that information elsewhere?
They can find a lot of the information elsewhere. But, you know, I would just submit to you that the number of reporters that you have, you know, on the streets, talking to people, finding stories, watching these, you know, virtual county meetings, it's not, there's certainly not as many maybe as it used to be. And, you know, if you watch, you know, one of these meetings, say you watch a county commission meeting that goes for 3 or 4 hours, you know, there are multiple stories coming out of those meetings. There's a lot of information that is not actually getting reported that come out of these meetings because the number of reporters covering it is relatively few compared to the amount of news that's out there. So, you know, I think there is a huge appetite for it. And, you know, I think there's an opportunity for local news organizations to, you know, to try to you know, tell stories that others aren't telling. There are any number of people always ask me, oh, well, how are you starting a business publication? You know, the Observer has business people who cover business. The Business Journal covers business. My response is there's so much news going on out there that they can't possibly cover it all.
I do worry about COVID fatigue, that said, because it is. It's COVID night and day. And I do worry that at some point readers are going to want something else. But there's just so much happening. Every day there are different announcements. There are just this morning, for example, they announced that the annual Pride celebrations are going to be canceled. So there's something going on all the time that right. needs our attention. But I do worry about fatigue.
And arts and culture kind of ended quickly when the shutdown, when the stay-at-home orders were issued and all the venues were closed, Ryan. And that puts a kind of crimp, a big crimp, on what you do, because that's what you cover. That is your bread and butter. So you've switched your coverage from the arts to health and coronavirus-centric material in recent weeks, and you've added at least a COVID-19 tab on your website. Obviously, that information is important to your readers, but is that what they're looking to you for? And if they accept that coverage from you, what are you doing to make that coverage more, I guess, targeted to them?
Right. Well, we, as far as the news coverage, is something we've always done. We have extended the news section out a little bit more as far as editorial wise, but we're also covering news, I mean, food stories, art stories, music stories, as to how these people are being affected by COVID-19 and sort of tying them in, while also finding creative ways to support those communities, because we feel like we're part of it. And we'll, just this week, we'll be rolling out a coloring book that we're going to be partnering with local artists for. That is a good way for our readers to spend their time during quarantine while also taking in art from local artists who will be making the art to color in with. And that's going to, half the profits are going to go back to the artists that submit their art into that. So we're all about just trying to find creative ways to try to continue to support those communities and just be inside those communities while this is all happening.
You all talked earlier in this program about having to work much harder now than you did before because of the changing nature of this COVID-19 outbreak and what it's done to you behind the scenes. That there's just the publishing aspect of this as opposed to just the editorial aspect of this. And Hilda, your publication, La Noticia, is in many cases the most valuable publication out there for the Latino community because many of them either don't speak English or they struggle with English because it's a second language. And you folks have to not only report on this, but you're getting these breaking news pieces of information coming from government sources in English that then you have to translate quickly and get it out. What is that doing to your staff? How are they coping with that? Because it's
overworked.
It has to go out quickly.
Very overworked. We have lots, very tired. We are not sleeping many hours in the night because we have to do that. We feel, of course, it's our responsibility. And not just translation. We have to translate in an accurate way, and we have to translate in a simple way so that our readers will be able to understand it. So that adds a lot of hours to our work. But, of course, we're very happy to do it.
You know, the big organizations are surviving this new paradigm of funding pretty well. We're talking about the New York Times and publications like that. Local journalism, it seems to me, is much smaller and therefore much more fragile in some cases in a normal economic environment and certainly during this coronavirus outbreak. But it's also this coronavirus outbreak, it seems to me, that maybe pointing out to people how valuable local is to them, because that's where it's all happening. It is not happening at the White House. It is not what they're telling you on CBS News or in the New York Times has nothing to do really with North Carolina or Charlotte in the big scheme of things. Do you think that this is the silver lining in this, perhaps, that people will discover just how valuable you are?
I do. I absolutely do. I hate to point out any positives to this. People are really hurting in a major way medically and economically. But I think that even coming back from this, there's going to be a need for businesses to advertise in all sorts of different ways. I think there's going to be a lot of reasons to partner as we're continuing to partner with different local businesses and local artists throughout this crisis. We're going to continue that on throughout this because we're all going to need to recover together, I think.
And Mike, your point is very well taken about local news being there for its community. I've gotten calls from reporters from both the New York Times and the New York Times and the Washington Post, who have had questions about our reporting, wanting Charlotte area sources, because they're not on the ground here. They don't know the community the way we do. I would like to think that, you know, we're like that corner pub or that corner restaurant that's owned by local people where you walk in and everyone knows who you are. We're not the big chains, but we're intimately familiar with our communities and we live in the communities we serve and we care very, very deeply about these communities.
There's also something you mentioned, Hilda, and I only have 30 seconds left, but there's a lot of collaboration, not just in the collaborative, but just in general going on among publications that used to be at each other with claws out, that nobody shared anything. Explain this sudden urge to share, and I literally have 15 seconds.
It's good because then it costs less because one news organization will create the news and then we all will share it and our audience will benefit from it.
And this program today is an example of that. Make note of these publications. Hilda Gurdian, founder publisher of La Noticia. Glenn Birkins, founder publisher of QCityMetro.com. Tony Messia, founder publisher of Charlotte Ledger. And Ryan Pitkin, co-founder of Queen City Nerd. Thank you all for the hour, and stay safe. Keep publishing.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.